is the Kool-Aid of human emotions. It's what you say when you spill a cup of coffee or throw a gutter ball when you're bowling with the girls in the league. True sorrow is as rare as true love. I'm not sorry that Tommy is dead anymore. He seems too much like a daydream I once had. You probably think that's cruel, but there's been a lot of water under the bridge since prom night. And I'm not sorry for my appearance before the White Commission. I told the truth, as much of it as I knew. But I am sorry for Carrie. They've forgotten her, you know. They've made her into some kind of a symbol and forgotten that she was a human being, as real as you reading this, with hopes and dreams and blah, blah, blah. Useless to tell you that, I suppose. Nothing can change her back now from something made out of newsprint into a person. But she was, and she hurt. More than any of us probably know, she hurt. And so I'm sorry, and I hope it was good for her, that prom. Until the terror began, I hope it was good and fine and wonderful and magic. Tommy pulled into the parking lot beside the high school's new wing, let the motor idle for just a second, and then switched it off. Carrie sat on her side of the seat, holding her wrap around her bare shoulders. It suddenly seemed to her that she was living in a dream of hidden intentions and had just become aware of the fact. What could she be doing? She had left Mama alone. Nervous? He asked, and she jumped. Yes. He laughed and got out. She was about to open her door when he opened it for her. Don't be nervous, he said. You're like Galatea. Who? Galatea. We read about her in Mr. Evers' class. She turned from a drudge into a beautiful woman and nobody even knew her. She considered it. I want them to know me, she said finally. I don't blame you. Come on. George Dawson and Frida Jason were standing by the Coke machine. Frida was in an orange tulle concoction and looked a little like a tuba. Donna Thibodeau was taking tickets at the door along with David Bracken. They were both National Honor Society members, part of Miss Gere's personal Gestapo, and they wore white slacks and red blazers, the school colors. Tina Blake and Norma Watson were handing out programs and seating people inside according to their chart. Both of them were dressed in black, and Carrie supposed they thought they were very chic. But to her, they looked like cigarette girls in an old gangster movie. All of them turned to look at Tommy and Carrie when they came in, and for a moment there was a stiff, awkward silence. Carrie felt a strong urge to wet her lips and controlled it. Then George Dawson said, "God, you look queer, Ross." Tommy smiled. "When did you come out of the treetops, Bumba?" Dawson lurched forward with his fists up, and for a moment Carrie felt stark terror. In her keyed-up state, she came within an ace of picking George up and throwing him across the lobby. Then she realized it was an old game, often played, well loved. The two of them sparred in a growling circle. Then George, who had been tagged twice in the ribs, began to gobble and yell, "Kill them Kongs! Get them Gooks! Pongy sticks! Tiger cages!" And Tommy collapsed his guard, laughing. "Don't let it bother you," Frida said, tilting her letter opener nose and strolling over. "If they kill each other, I'll dance with you." "They look too stupid to kill," Carrie ventured, "like dinosaurs." And when Frida grinned, she felt something very old and rusty loosen inside her. A warmth came with it. Relief. Ease. "Where'd you buy your dress?" Frida asked. "I love it." "I made it." "Made it?" Frida's eyes opened in unaffected surprise. "No shit?" Carrie felt herself blushing furiously. "Yes, I did. I like to sew. I got the material at John's in Westover. The pattern is really quite easy." "Come on," George said to all of them in general. "Band's gonna start." He rolled his eyes and went through a limber, satiric buck and wing. Vibes, vibes, vibes. Us gooks love them big Fender vibrations. When they went in, George was doing impressions of Flash Bobby Pickett and mugging. Carrie was telling Frida about her dress, and Tommy was grinning, hands stuffed in his pockets. Spoil the lines of his dinner jacket, Sue would be telling him. But fuck it, it seemed to be working. So far, it was working fine. He and George and Frida had less than 2 hours to live. From The Shadow Exploded, page 132. The White Commission stand on the trigger of the whole affair, two buckets of pig blood on a beam over the stage, seems to be overly weak and vacillating, even in the light of the scant concrete proof. If one chooses to believe the hearsay evidence of Nolan's immediate circle of friends, and to be brutally frank, they do not seem intelligent enough to lie convincingly, then Nolan took this part of the conspiracy entirely out of Christine Hargensen's hands and acted on his own initiative. He didn't talk when he drove. He liked to drive. The operation gave him a feeling of power that nothing could rival, not even fucking. The road unrolled before them in photographic blacks and whites, and the speedometer trembled just past 70. He came from a broken home. His father had taken off after the failure of a badly managed gas station venture when Billy was 12, and his mother had four boyfriends at last count. Brucey was in greatest favor right now. He was a Seagram 7 man. She was turning into one ugly bag, too. But the car fed him power and glory from its own mystic lines of force. It made him someone to be reckoned with, someone with mana. It was not by accident that he had done most of his bawling in the back seat. The car was his slave and his god. It gave and it could take away. Billy had used it to take away many times, on long sleepless nights, when his mother and Brucey were fighting. Billy made popcorn and went out cruising for stray dogs. Some mornings, he let the car roll, engine dead, into the garage he had constructed behind the house, with its front bumper dripping. She knew his habits well enough by now, and did not bother making conversation that would simply be ignored anyway. She sat beside him, with one leg curled under her, gnawing a knuckle. The lights of the car streaking past them on 302 gleamed softly in her hair, streaking it silver. He wondered how long she would last. Maybe not long after tonight. Somehow it had all led to this, even the early part. And when it was done, the glue that had held them together would be thin and might dissolve, leaving them to wonder how it could have been in the first place. He thought she would start to look less like a goddess and more like the typical society bitch again, and that would make him want to belt her around a little. Or maybe a lot. Rubber nose in it. They breasted the brickyard hill, and there was the high school below them. The parking lot filled with plump, glistening daddy's cars. He felt the familiar gorge of disgust and hate rise in his throat. "We'll give them something. A night to remember." "All right. We can do that." The classroom wings were dark and silent and deserted. The lobby was lit with a standard yellow glow, and the bank of glass that was the gymnasium's east side glowed with a soft, orangey light that was ethereal, almost ghostly. Again the bitter taste and the urge to throw rocks. "I see the lights. I see the party lights," he murmured. "Huh?" She turned to him, startled out of her own thoughts. "Nothing." He touched the nape of her neck. "I think I'm gonna let you pull the string." Billy did it by himself because he knew perfectly well that he could trust nobody else. That had been a hard lesson, much harder than the ones they taught you in school, but he had learned it well. The boys who had gone with him to Henny's place the night before had not even known what he wanted the blood for. They probably suspected Chris was involved, but they could not even be sure of that. He drove to the school minutes after Thursday night had become Friday morning and cruised by twice to make sure it was deserted and neither of Chamberlain's two police cars was in the area. He drove into the parking lot with his lights off and swung around in back of the building. Further back, the football field glimmered beneath a thin membrane of ground fog. He opened the trunk and unlocked the ice chest. The blood had frozen solid, but that was all right. It would have the next 22 hours to thaw. He put the buckets on the ground, then got a number of tools from his kit. He stuck them in his back pocket and grabbed a brown bag from the seat. Screws clinked inside. He worked without hurry, with the easeful concentration of one who is unable to conceive of interruption. The gym where the dance was to be held was also the school auditorium, and the small row of windows looking toward where he had parked opened on the backstage storage area. He selected a flat tool with a spatulate end and slid it through the small jointure between the upper and lower panes of one window. It was a good tool. He had made it himself in the Chamberlain Metal Shop. He wiggled it until the window's slip lock came free. He pushed the window up and slid in. It was very dark. The predominant odor was of old paint from the Dramatics Club canvas flats. The gaunt shadows of band society, music stands, and instrument cases stood around like sentinels. Mr. Downer's piano stood in one corner. Billy took a small flashlight out of the bag and made his way to the stage and stepped through the red velvet curtains. The gym floor, with its painted basketball lines and highly varnished surface, glimmered at him like an amber lagoon. He shone his light on the apron in front of the curtain. There, in ghostly chalk lines, someone had drawn the floor silhouette of the king and queen thrones, which would be placed the following day. Then the entire apron would be strewn with paper flowers. Why, Christ only knew. He craned his neck and shone the beam of his light up into the shadows. Overhead, girders crisscrossed in shadowy lines. The girders over the dance floor had been sheathed in crepe paper, but the area directly over the apron hadn't been decorated. A short draw curtain obscured the girders up there, and they were invisible from the gym floor. The draw curtain also hid a bank of lights that would highlight the gondola mural. Billy turned off the flashlight, walked to the left-hand edge of the apron, and mounted a steel-runged ladder bolted to the wall. The contents of his brown bag, which he had tucked into his shirt for safety, jingled with a strange, hollow jolliness in the deserted gymnasium. At the top of the ladder was a small platform. Now, as he faced outward toward the apron, the stage flies were to his right, the gym itself on his left. In the flies, the Dramatics Club props were stored, some of them dating back to the 1920s. A bust of Pallas, used in some ancient dramatic version of Poe's The Raven, stared at Billy with blind, floating eyes from atop a rusting bedspring. Straight ahead, a steel girder ran out over the apron. Lights to be used against the mural were bolted to the bottom of it. He stepped out onto it and walked effortlessly, without fear, out over the drop. He was humming a popular tune under his breath. The beam was inch thick with dust, and he left long, shuffling tracks. Halfway out, he stopped, dropped to his knees, and peered down. Yes! With the help of his light, he could make out the chalk lines on the apron directly below. He made a soundless whistling. Bombs away. He X'd the precise spot on the dust, then beam-walked back to the platform. No one would be up here between now and the ball. The lights that shone on the mural and on the apron where the king and queen would be crowned, they'll get crowned all right, were controlled from a box backstage. Anyone looking up from directly below would be blinded by those same lights. His arrangements would be noticed only if someone went up into the flies for something. He didn't believe anyone would. It was an acceptable risk. He opened the brown bag and took out a pair of Playtex rubber gloves, put them on, and then took out one of two small pulleys he had purchased yesterday. He had gotten them at a hardware store in Lewiston, just to be safe. He popped a number of nails into his mouth like cigarettes and got the hammer. Still humming around his mouth full of nails, he fixed the pulley neatly in the corner a foot above the platform. Beside it, he fixed a small eyehole screw. He went back down the ladder, crossed backstage, and climbed another ladder not far from where he had come in. He was in the loft, sort of a catch-all school attic. Here there were stacks of old yearbooks, moth-eaten athletic uniforms, and ancient textbooks that had been nibbled by mice. Looking left, he could shine his light over the stage flies and spotlight the pulley he had just put up. Turning right, cool night air played on his face from a vent in the wall. Still humming, he took out the second pulley and nailed it up. He went back down, crawled out the window he had forced, and got the two buckets of pig blood. He had been about his business for a half hour, but it showed no signs of thawing. He picked the buckets up and walked back to the window, silhouetted in the darkness like a farmer coming back from the first milking. He lifted them inside and went in after. Beam walking was easier with a bucket in each hand for balance. When he reached his dust-marked X, he put the buckets down, peered at the chalk marks on the apron once more, nodded, and walked back to the platform. He thought about wiping the buckets on his last trip out to them. Kenny's prints would be on them, Don's and Steve's as well. But it was better not to. Maybe they would have a little surprise on Saturday morning. The thought made his lips quirk. The last item in the bag was a coil of jute twine. He walked back out to the buckets and tied the handles of both with running slip knots. He threaded the screw, then the pulley. He threw the uncoiling twine across to the loft, and then threaded that one. He probably would not have been amused to know that in the gloom of the auditorium, covered and streaked with decades-old dust, gray kitties flying dreamily about his crow's nest hair, he looked like a hunched, half-mad Rube Goldberg, intent upon creating the better mousetrap. He piled the slack twine on top of a stack of crates within reach of the vent. He climbed down for the last time and dusted off his hands. The thing was done. He looked out the window, then wriggled through and thumped to the ground. He closed the window, reinserted his jimmy, and closed the lock as far as he could. Then he went back to his car. Chris said chances were good that Tommy Ross and the white bitch would be the ones under the buckets. She had been doing a little quiet promoting among her friends. That would be good if it happened. But for Billy, any of the others would be all right, too. He was beginning to think that it would be all right if it was Chris herself. He drove away. From My Name is Susan Snell, page 48. Carrie went to see Tommy the day before the prom. She was waiting outside one of his classes, and he said she looked really wretched, as if she thought he'd yell at her to stop hanging around and stop bugging him. She said she had to be in by 11:30 at the latest, or her mama would be worried. She said she wasn't going to spoil his time or anything, but it wouldn't be fair to worry her mama. Tommy suggested they stop at the Kelly Fruit after and grab a root beer and a burger. All the other kids would be going to Westover or Lewiston, and they would have the place to themselves. Carrie's face lit up, he said. She told him that would be fine, just fine. This is the girl they keep calling a monster. I want you to keep that firmly in mind. The girl who could be satisfied with a hamburger and a dime root beer, after her only school dance so her mama wouldn't be worried. The first thing that struck Carrie when they walked in was glamour. Not glamour, but glamour. Beautiful shadows rustled about in chiffon, lace, silk, satin. The air was redolent with the odor of flowers. The nose was constantly amazed by it. Girls in dresses with low backs, with scooped bodices showing actual cleavage, with empire waists, long skirts, pumps, blinding white dinner jackets, cummerbunds, black shoes that had been spit-shined. A few people were on the dance floor, not many yet, and in the soft, revolving gloom, they were wraiths without substance. She did not really want to see them as her classmates. She wanted them to be beautiful strangers. Tommy's hand was firm on her elbow. "The mural's nice," he said. "Yes," she agreed faintly. It had taken on a soft netherlight under the orange spots, the boatman leaning with eternal indolence against his tiller, while the sunset blazed around him and the buildings conspired together over urban waters. She knew with suddenness and ease that this moment would be with her always, within hand's reach of memory. She doubted if they all sensed it. They had seen the world, but even George was silent for a minute as they looked, and the scene, the smell, even the sound of the band playing a faintly recognizable movie theme, was locked forever in her, and she was at peace. Her soul knew a moment's calm, as if it had been uncrumpled and smoothed under an iron. "Vibes!" George yelled suddenly, and led Frida out onto the floor. He began to do a sarcastic jitterbug to the old-timey big band music, and someone catcalled over to him. George blabbered, leered, and went into a brief arms-cross Cossack routine that nearly landed him on his butt. Carrie smiled. "George is funny," she said. "Sure he is. He's a good guy. There are lots of good people around. Want to sit down?" "Yes," she said gratefully. He went back to the door and returned with Norma Watson, whose hair had been pulled into a huge teased explosion for the affair. "It's on the other side," she said, and her bright gerbil's eyes picked Carrie up and down, looking for an exposed strap, an eruption of pimples, any news to carry back to the door when her errand was done. "That's a lovely dress, Carrie. Where did you ever get it?" Carrie told her while Norma led them around the dance floor to their table. She exuded odors of Avon soap, Woolworth's perfume, and juicy fruit gum. There were two folding chairs at the table, looped and beribboned with the inevitable crepe paper, and the table itself was decked with crepe paper in the school colors. On top was a candle in a wine bottle, a dance program, a tiny gilded pencil, and two party favors, gondolas filled with Planters mixed nuts. "I can't get over it," Norma was saying. "You look so different." She cast an odd, furtive look at Carrie's face, and it made her feel nervous. "You're positively glowing. What's your secret?" "I'm Don McLean's secret lover," Carrie said. Tommy sniggered and quickly smothered it. Norma's smile slipped a notch, and Carrie was amazed by her own wit and audacity. That's what you looked like when the joke was on you, as though a bee had stung your rear end. Carrie found she liked Norma to look that way. It was distinctly unchristian. "Well, I have to get back," she said. "Isn't it exciting, Tommy?" Her smile was sympathetic. "Wouldn't it be exciting if..." "Cold sweat is running down my thighs in rivers," Tommy said gravely. Norma left with an odd, puzzled smile. It had not gone the way things were supposed to go. Everyone knew how things were supposed to go with Carrie. Tommy sniggered again. "Would you like to dance?" he asked. She didn't know how, but wasn't ready to admit to that yet. "Let's just sit down for a minute." While he held out her chair, she saw the candle and asked Tommy if he would light it. He did. Their eyes met over its flame. He reached out and took her hand. And the band played on. From the Shadow Exploded, pages 133 through 134. Perhaps a complete study of Carrie's mother will be undertaken someday, when the subject of Carrie herself becomes more academic. I myself might attempt it, if only to gain access to the Brigham family tree. It might be extremely interesting to know what odd occurrences one might come across two or three generations back. And there is, of course, the knowledge that Carrie went home on prom night. Why? It is hard to tell just how sane Carrie's motives were by that time. She may have gone for absolution and forgiveness, or she may have gone for the express purpose of committing matricide. In any event, the physical evidence seems to indicate that Margaret White was waiting for her. The house was completely silent. She was gone. At night, gone. Margaret White walked slowly from her bedroom into the living room. First had come the flow of blood and the filthy fantasies the devil sent with it. Then this hellish power the devil had given to her. It came at the time of the blood and the time of hair on the body, of course. Oh, she knew the devil's power. Her own grandmother had it. She had been able to light the fireplace without ever stirring from her rocker by the window. It made her eyes glow with, "Thou shalt not suffer a witch to live," a kind of witch's light. And sometimes, at the supper table, the sugar bowl would whirl madly like a dervish. Whenever it happened, Graham would cackle crazily and drool and make the sign of the evil eye all around her. Sometimes she panted like a dog on a hot day, and when she died of a heart attack at 66, senile to the point of idiocy even at that early age, Carrie had not even been a year old. Margaret had gone into her bedroom not 4 weeks after Graham's funeral, and there her girl child had lain in her crib, laughing and gurgling, watching a bottle that was dangling in thin air over her head. Margaret had almost killed her then. Ralph had stopped her. She should not have let him stop her. Now Margaret White stood in the middle of the living room. Christ on Calvary looked down at her with his wounded, suffering, reproachful eyes. The Black Forest cuckoo clock ticked. It was 8:10. She had been able to feel, actually feel, the devil's power working in Carrie. It crawled all over you, lifting and pulling like evil, tickling little fingers. She had set out to do her duty again when Carrie was 3, when she had caught her looking in sin at the devil's slut in the next yard over. Then the stones had come, and she had weakened, and the power had risen again after 13 years. God was not mocked. First the blood, then the power. You sign your name. You sign it in blood. Now a boy and dancing, and he would take her to a roadhouse after, take her into the parking lot, take her into the back seat, take her. Blood, fresh blood. Blood was always at the root of it, and only blood could expiate it. She was a big woman with massive upper arms that had dwarfed her elbows to dimples, but her head was surprisingly small on the end of her strong, corded neck. It had once been a beautiful face. It was still beautiful in a weird, zealous way. But the eyes had taken on a strange, wandering cast, and the lines had deepened cruelly around the denying but oddly weak mouth. Her hair, which had been almost all black a year ago, was now almost white. The only way to kill sin, true black sin, was to drown it in the blood of, she must be sacrificed, a repentant heart. Surely God understood that and had laid his finger upon her. Had not God himself commanded Abraham to take his son Isaac up upon the mountain? She shuffled out into the kitchen in her old and splayed slippers and opened the kitchen utensil drawer. The knife they used for carving was long and sharp and arched in the middle from constant honing. She sat down on the high stool by the counter, found the sliver of whetstone in its small aluminum dish, and began to scrub it along the gleaming edge of the blade with the apathetic, fixated attention of the damned. The Black Forest cuckoo clock ticked and ticked, and finally the bird jumped out to call once and announce 8:30. In her mouth she tasted olives. The senior class presents Spring Ball 79, May 27, 1979. Music by the Billy Bosnan Band. Music by Josie and the Moonglows. Entertainment: Cabaret, Baton Twirling by Sandra Stenchfield. 500 Miles, Lemon Tree, Mr. Tambourine Man. Folk music by John Swithin and Maureen Cowan. The Street Where You Live, Raindrops Keep Falling on My Head, Bridge Over Troubled Waters, Ewan High School Chorus. Chaperones: Mr. Stevens, Miss Gear, Mr. and Mrs. Lublin, Miss Desjardin. Coronation at 10 p.m. Remember, it's your prom. Make it one to remember always. When he asked her the third time, Carrie had to admit that she didn't know how to dance. She didn't add that, now the rock band had taken over for a half-hour set, she would feel out of place gyrating on the floor. And sinful. Yes, and sinful. Tommy nodded, then smiled. He leaned forward and told her that he hated to dance. Would she like to go around and visit some of the other tables? Trepidation rose thickly in her throat, but she nodded. Yes, that would be nice. He was seeing to her. She must see to him, even if he really did not expect it. That was part of the deal. And she felt dusted over with the enchantment of the evening. She was suddenly hopeful that no one would stick out a foot or slyly paste a kick-me-hard sign on her back or suddenly squirt water in her face from a novelty carnation and retreat crackling while everyone laughed and pointed and catcalled. And if here was enchantment, it was not divine but pagan. "Mama, untie your apron strings. I'm getting big." And she wanted it that way. "Look," he said as they got up. Two or three stagehands were sliding the king and queen thrones from the wings, while Mr. Lavoie, the head custodian, directed them with hand motions toward preset marks on the apron. She thought they looked quite Arthurian, those thrones, dressed all in blinding white, strewn with real flowers as well as huge crepe banners. "They're beautiful," she said. "You're beautiful," Tommy said, and she became quite sure that nothing bad could happen this night. Perhaps they themselves might even be voted king and queen of the prom. She smiled at her own folly. It was 9 o'clock. "Carrie?" a voice said hesitantly. She had been so wrapped up in watching the band and the dance floor and the other tables that she hadn't seen anyone coming at all. Tommy had gone to get them punch. She turned around and saw Miss Desjardin. For a moment, the two of them merely looked at each other, and the memory traveled between them, communicated. She saw me naked and screaming and bloody. Without words or thought, it was in her eyes. Then Carrie said shyly, "You look very pretty, Miss Desjardin." She did. She was dressed in a glimmering silver sheath, a perfect complement to her blonde hair, which was up. A simple pendant hung around her neck. She looked very young, young enough to be attending rather than chaperoning. "Thank you," she hesitated. then put a gloved hand on Carrie's arm. "You are beautiful," she said, and each word carried a peculiar emphasis. Carrie felt herself blushing again and dropped her eyes to the table. "It's awfully nice of you to say so. I know I'm not really, but thank you anyway." "It's true," Desjardins said. "Carrie, anything that happened before, well, it's all forgotten. I wanted you to know that." "I can't forget it," Carrie said. She looked up. The words that rose to her lips were, "I don't blame anyone anymore." She bit them off. It was a lie. She blamed them all, and always would, and she wanted more than anything else to be honest. "But it's over with. Now it's over with." Miss Desjardins smiled, and her eyes seemed to catch and hold the soft mix of lights in an almost liquid sparkling. She looked across toward the dance floor, and Carrie followed her gaze. "I remember my own prom," Desjardins said softly. "I was 2 inches taller than the boy I went with when I was in my heels. He gave me a corsage that clashed with my gown. The tailpipe was broken on his car, and the engine made, oh, an awful racket. But it was magic. I don't know why, but I've never had a date like it, ever again." She looked at Carrie. "Is it like that for you?" "It's very nice," Carrie said.
"And is that all?"
"No, there's more. I couldn't tell it all, not to anybody." Desjardins smiled and squeezed her arm. "You'll never forget it," she said. "Never." "I think you're right. Have a lovely time, Carrie." "Thank you." Tommy came up with 2 Dixie cups of punch as Desjardins left, walking around the dance floor toward the chaperone's table. "What did she want?" he asked, putting the Dixie cups down carefully. Carrie, looking after her, said, "I think she wanted to say she was sorry." Sue Snell sat quietly in the living room of her home, hemming a dress and listening to the Jefferson Airplane Long John Silver album. It was old and badly scratched, but soothing. Her mother and father had gone out for the evening. They knew what was going on, she was sure of that. But they spared her the bumbling talks about how proud they were of their girl, or how glad they were that she was finally growing up. She was glad they had decided to leave her alone, because she was still uncomfortable about her own motives and afraid to examine them too deeply, lest she discover a jewel of selfishness glowing and winking at her from the black velvet of her subconscious. She had done it. That was enough. She was satisfied. Maybe he'll fall in love with her. She looked up as if someone had spoken from the hallway, a startled smile curving her lips. That would be a fairy tale ending, all right. The prince bends over the sleeping beauty, touches his lips to hers. "Sue, I don't know how to tell you this, but..." The smile faded. Her period was late, almost a week late, and she had always been as regular as an almanac. The record changer clicked. Another record dropped down. In the sudden, brief silence, she heard something within her turn over, perhaps only her soul. It was 9:15. Billy drove to the far end of the parking lot and pulled into a stall that faced the asphalt ramp leading to the highway. Chris started to get out, and he jerked her back. His eyes glowed fairly in the dark. "What?" she said with angry nervousness. "They use a PA system to announce the king and queen," he said. "Then one of the bands will play the school song. That means they're sitting there in those thrones, on target." "I know all that. Let go of me. You're hurting." He squeezed her wrist tighter still and felt small bones grind. It gave him a grim pleasure. Still, she didn't cry out. She was pretty good. "You listen to me. I want you to know what you're getting into. Pull the rope when the song is playing. Pull it hard. There will be a little slack between the pulleys, but not much. When you pull it and feel those buckets go, run. You don't stick around to hear the screams or anything else. This is out of the cute little joke league. This is criminal assault, you know? They don't fine you. They put you in jail and throw the key over their shoulder. It was an enormous speech for him. Her eyes only glared at him, full of defiant anger. Dig it? Yes. All right. When the buckets go, I'm going to run. When I get to the car, I'm going to drive away. If you're there, you can come. If you're not, I'll leave you. If I leave you and you spill your guts, I'll kill you. Do you believe me? Yes, take your fucking hand off me. He did. An unwilling shadow grin touched his face. Okay, it's gonna be good. They got out of the car. It was almost 9:30. Vic Mooney, president of the senior class, was calling jovially into the mic. All right, ladies and gentlemen, take your seats, please. It's time for the voting. We're going to vote for the king and queen. This contest insults women, Myra Cruz called with uneasy good nature. It insults men, too, George Dawson called back, and there was general laughter. Myra was silent. She had made her token protest. Take your seats, please. Vic was smiling into the mic, smiling and blushing furiously, fingering a pimple on his chin. The huge Venetian boatman behind him looked dreamily over Vic's shoulder. Time to vote. Carrie and Tommy sat down. Tina Blake and Norma Watson were circulating mimeograph ballots, and when Norma dropped one at their table and breathed, "Good luck," Carrie picked up the ballot and studied it. Her mouth popped open. "Tommy, we're on here." "Yeah, I saw that," he said. "The school votes for single candidates, and their dates get sort of shanghaied into it. Welcome aboard. Shall we decline?" She bit her lip and looked at him. "Do you want to decline?" "Hell no," he said cheerfully. "If you win, all you do is sit up there for the school song and one dance and wave a scepter and look like a goddamn idiot. They take your picture for the yearbook so everyone can see you look like a goddamn idiot." "Who do we vote for?" She looked doubtfully from the ballot to the tiny pencil by her boat full of nuts. "They're more your crowd than mine." A little chuckle escaped her. "In fact, I don't really have a crowd." He shrugged. "Let's vote for ourselves. To the devil with false modesty." She laughed out loud, then clapped a hand over her mouth. The sound was almost entirely foreign to her. Before she could think, she circled their names. Third from the top. The tiny pencil broke in her hand and she gasped. A splinter had scratched the pad of one finger, and a small bead of blood welled. "You hurt yourself?" "No," she smiled, but suddenly it was difficult to smile. The sight of the blood was distasteful to her. She blotted it away with her napkin. "But I broke the pencil, and it was a souvenir. Stupid me." "There's your boat," he said, and pushed it toward her. "Toot, toot." Her throat closed, and she felt sure she would weep and then be ashamed. She did not, but her eyes glimmered like prisms, and she lowered her head so he would not see. The band was playing catchy fill-in music while the Honor Society ushers collected the folded-over ballots. They were taken to the chaperone's table by the door, where Vic and Mr. Stevens and the Lublins counted them. Miss Gear surveyed it all with grim, gimlet eyes. Carrie felt an unwilling tension worm into her, tightening muscles in her stomach and back. She held Tommy's hand tightly. It was absurd, of course. No one was going to vote for them. The stallion, perhaps, but not when harnessed in tandem with a she-ox. It would be Frank and Jessica, or maybe Don Farnham and Helen Shires, or hell. Two piles were growing larger than the others. Mr. Stevens finished dividing the slips, and all four of them took turns at counting the large piles, which looked about the same. They put their heads together, conferred, and counted once more. Mr. Stevens nodded, thumbed the ballots once more like a man about to deal a hand of poker, and gave them back to Vic. He climbed back on stage and approached the mic. The Billy Bosnan band played a flourish. Vic smiled nervously, harumphed into the mic, and blinked at the sudden feedback whine. He nearly dropped the balance to the floor, which was covered with heavy electrical cables, and somebody snickered. "We've sort of hit a snag," Vic said artlessly. "Mr. Lublin says this is the first time in the history of the spring ball." "How far does he go back?" someone behind Tommy grumbled. 1800? "We've got a tie." This got a murmur from the crowd. "Polka dot or striped?" George Dawson called, and there was some laughter. Vic gave a twitchy little smile and almost dropped the ballots again. 63 votes for Frank Greer and Jessica McLean, and 63 votes for Thomas Ross and Carrie White. This was followed by a moment of silence, and then sudden, swelling applause. Tommy looked across at his date. Her head was lowered, as if in shame, but he had a sudden feeling. Carrie, Carrie, Carrie. Not unlike the one he had had when he asked her to the prom. His mind felt as if something alien was moving in there, calling Carrie's name over and over again, as if, "Attention," Vic was calling. "If I could have your attention, please." The applause quieted. "We're going to have a runoff ballot. When the people passing out the slips of paper get to you, please write the couple you favor on it." He left the mic, looking relieved. The ballots were circulated. They had been hastily torn from leftover prom programs. The band played unnoticed, and people talked excitedly. "They weren't applauding for us," Carrie said, looking up. The thing he had felt, or thought he had felt, was gone. "It couldn't have been for us." "Maybe it was for you." She looked at him, mute. "What's taking it so long?" she hissed at him. "I heard them clap. Maybe that was it. If you fucked up." The length of jute cord hung limply, untouched since Billy had poked a screwdriver through the vent and lifted it out. "Don't worry," he said calmly. "They'll play the school song. They always do." "But shut up. You talk too fucking much." The tip of his cigarette winked peacefully in the dark. "She's shut, but, oh, when this is over, you're going to get it, buddy. Maybe you'll go to bed with lover's nuts tonight." Her mind ran furiously over his words, storing them. People did not speak to her in such a manner. Her father was a lawyer. It was 7:57. He was holding the broken pencil in his hand, ready to write, when she touched his wrist, lightly, tentatively. "Don't."
"What?"
"Don't vote for us," she said finally. He raised his eyebrows quizzically. "Why not? In for a penny, in for a pound. That's what my mother always says." "Mother." A picture rose in her mind instantly. Her mother droning endless prayers to a towering, faceless, columnar god who prowled roadhouse parking lots with a sword of fire in one hand. Terror rose in her blackly, and she had to fight with all her spirit to hold it back. She could not explain her dread, her sense of premonition. She could only smile helplessly and repeat, "Don't, please." The Honor Society ushers were coming back, collecting folded slips. He hesitated a moment longer, then suddenly scrawled "Tommy and Carrie" on the ragged slip of paper. "For you," he said. "Tonight you go first class." She could not reply, for the premonition was on her. Her mother's face. The knife slipped from the whetstone, and in an instant it had sliced the cup of her palm below the thumb. She looked at the cut. It bled slowly, thickly from the open lips of the wound, running out of her hand and spotting the worn linoleum of the kitchen floor. Good, then. It was good. The blade had tasted flesh and let blood. She did not bandage it, but tipped the flow over the cutting edge, letting the blood dull the blade's sharp glimmer. Then she began to sharpen again, heedless of the droplets which splattered her dress. If thine right eye offend thee, pluck it out. If it was a hard scripture, it was also sweet and good, a fitting scripture for those who lurked in the doorway shadows of one-night hotels and in the weeds behind bowling alleys. Pluck it out. Oh, and the nasty music they play. Pluck it. Beware how it sweats blood. Out. The Black Forest cuckoo clock began to strike 10, and cut her guts out on the floor. If thine right eye offend thee, pluck it out. The dress was done, and she could not watch the television, or take out her books, or call Nancy on the phone. There was nothing to do but sit on the sofa facing the blackness of the kitchen window and feel some nameless sort of fear growing in her like an infant coming to dreadful term. With a sigh, she began to massage her arms absently. They were cold and prickly. It was 12 after 10, and there was no reason, really no reason, to feel that the world was coming to an end. The stacks were higher this time, but they still looked exactly the same. Again, 3 counts were taken to make sure. Then Vic Mooney went to the mic again. He paused a moment, relishing the blue feel of tension in the air, and then announced simply, "Tommy and Carrie win, by 1 vote." Dead silence for a moment. Then applause filled the hall again, some of it not without satiric overtones. Carrie drew in a startled, smothered gasp, and Tommy again felt, but for only a second, that weird vertigo in his mind. Carrie, 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 Carrie. That seemed to blank out all thought but the name and image of this strange girl he was with. For a fleeting second, he was literally scared shitless. Something fell on the floor with a clink, and at the same instant the candle between them whiffed out. Then Josie and the Moonglows were playing a rock version of Pomp and Circumstance. The ushers appeared at their table, almost magically. All this had been rehearsed meticulously by Miss Gear, who, according to rumor, ate slow and clumsy ushers for lunch. A scepter, wrapped in aluminum foil, was thrust into Tommy's hand. A robe with a lush dog fur collar was thrown over Carrie's shoulders, and they were being led down the center aisle by a boy and a girl in white blazers. The band blared. The audience applauded. Miss Gear looked vindicated. Tommy Ross was grinning bemusedly. They were ushered up the steps to the apron, led across to the thrones, and seated. Still the applause swelled. The sarcasm in it was lost now. It was honest and deep. A little frightening. Carrie was glad to sit down. It was all happening too fast. Her legs were trembling under her, and suddenly, even with the comparatively high neck of her gown, her breasts, dirty pillows, felt dreadfully exposed. The sound of the applause in her ears made her feel woozy, almost punch drunk. Part of her was actually convinced that all this was a dream from which she would wake with mixed feelings of loss and relief. Vic boomed into the mic. "The King and Queen of the 1979 Spring Ball, Tommy Ross and Carrie White." Still applause, swelling and booming and crackling. Tommy Ross, in the fading moments of his life now, took Carrie's hand and grinned at her, thinking that Susie's intuition had been very right. Somehow she grinned back. Tommy, she was right, and I love her. Well, I love this one, too. This Carrie, she is beautiful, and it's right. I love all of them. The light in her eyes. And Carrie, can't see them. The lights are too bright. I can hear them, but can't see them. The shower, remember, the shower. Oh, Mama, it's too high. I think I want to get down. Oh, are they laughing and ready to throw things, to point and scream with laughter? I can't see them. I can't see them. It's all too bright. And the beam above them. Both bands, in a sudden and serendipitous coalition of rock and brass, swung into the school song. The audience rose to its feet and began to sing, still applauding. It was 10:07. Billy had just flexed his knees to make the joints pop. Chris Hargensen stood next to him with increasing signs of nervousness. Her hands played aimlessly along the seams of the jeans she had worn, and she was biting the softness of her lower lip, chewing at it, making it a little ragged. "You think they'll vote for them?" Billy said softly. "They will," she said. "I set it up. It won't even be close. Why do they keep applauding? What's going on in there?"
"Don't ask me, babe."
The school song suddenly roared out, full and strong on the soft May air, and Chris jumped as if stung. A soft gasp of surprise escaped her. "All rise high for Thomas Ewan High."
"Go on," he said. "They're there."
His eyes glowed softly in the dark. The odd half-grin had touched his features. She licked her lips. They both stared at the length of jute cord. "We'll raise your banners to the sky."
"Shut up," she whispered.
She was trembling, and he thought that her body had never looked so lush or exciting. When this was over, he was going to have her until every other time she'd been had was like two pumps with a fag's little finger. He was going on her like a raw cob through butter.
"No guts, babe?"
He leaned forward.
"I won't pull it for you, babe. It can sit there till hell freezes.
With pride we wear the red and white." A sudden smothered sound that might have been a half scream came from her mouth, and she leaned forward and pulled violently on the cord with both hands. It came loose with slack for a moment, making her think that Billy had been having her on all this time, that the rope was attached to nothing but thin air. Then it snubbed tight, held for a second, and then came through her palms harshly, leaving a thin burn. She began. The music inside came to a jangling, discordant halt. For a moment, ragged voices continued oblivious, and then they stopped. There was a beat of silence, and then someone screamed. Silence again. They stared at each other in the dark, frozen by the actual act as thought never could have done. Her very breath turned to glass in her throat. Then, inside, the laughter began. It was 10:25, and the feeling had been getting worse and worse. Sue stood in front of the gas range on one foot, waiting for the milk to begin steaming so she could dump in the Nestle's. Twice she had begun to go upstairs and put on a nightgown, and twice she had stopped, drawn for no reason at all to the kitchen window that looked down Brickyard Hill and the spiral of Route 6 that led into town. Now, as the whistle mounted atop the town hall on Main Street, suddenly began to shriek into the night, rising and falling in cycles of panic. She did not even turn immediately to the window, but only turned the heat off under the milk so it would not burn. The town hall whistle went off every day at 12 noon, and that was all.